Yeah, no, no, that's all fine. I think this laptop's better than my old laptop, which is not surprising. It cost a lot more. And it's brand new.
What'd you get?
Fuck.
It'll say it on the laptop, Kirsten. It shouldn't be a mystery. You should just look at the laptop and know what it is. It should say it there on the laptop. What did you get?
Have I mentioned how tired I am? It's a I couldn't think of the letters. It's a HP Envy.
Do they sell computers in Ballarat? Do they have technology there?
Well, you've got to send your carrier pigeon with a message to say you need one. And then a guy comes in his horse and cart with a few laptops. And some of them are from the 80s. So that's like, and they need a Clydesdale to drag them around. But I was really lucky and they had a brand new one.
Welcome to episode 72 of Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I am Ian Mond, your host, and I am on my own. No, I'm not. That's a lie. I have Kirsten McDermott here who has her brand new laptop. She's now going to spend the next hour regaling us with her laptop stories.
No, I don't need to tell you about my laptop. It's a good laptop. It's fine. We can continue. This is not a podcast about laptops.
Here I am trying to do small talk, to break the ice. And,
that ice has been broken so long ago.
So in this new and improved Writer and the Critic pandemic version, we just get straight to the point these days.
We pretty much do. No one has time for small talk.
No, it's true. So should we mention our new patron?
We should, definitely.
It's Louise. So thank you very much, Louise, for joining up. Your money will go to pay off my house if I have one.
No, it will go off to paying for our hosting, which I've had to upgrade because now that I'm uploading new episodes, I can't keep it on the sort of the hold pattern cheap hosting anymore. I've got to go back to paying real money every month. So, yes, thank you to our lovely patrons. You are keeping us in servers.
And thank you to the people on Facebook who have been saying nice things about at least last month's episode. It's good to know that we're not screaming, at least in my case, screaming.
Into the void?
Into the void, yes. Whereas you, Kirsten, are being very articulate. I do a lot of...
I don't know. I can't even remember what I say 2 minutes after I say it anymore.
Yeah, it's funny having people repeat back what we said in an episode and I don't even know those words.
I don't remember. I think I have to listen to that again to know what I said.
I don't know what you're referring to. So, it's amazing what comes out of our mouths and we just have no...
And the funny thing is, Ian, you never hear it again. I actually do, because I hear the whole thing again when I go back and edit it and I still can't remember what I said.
No, I can't bear listening to it again because I have a certain pitch of voice that I find extremely irritating. I find my own voice very irritating.
A lot of people do.
My voice irritating. Thanks, Kirk.
Their own voices, I meant. But just take comfort in the fact, it's not much comfort, but just take comfort in the fact that that's how everybody hears you all the time.
Let's go on to the first book, which is Weather by Jenny Offal, which was my choice.
Yes.
So I'll first just describe, we'll just do the whole back of the book
readout,
and then we'll talk a bit about who Jenny Offal is and why I chose it. So Weather by Jenny Offal. I'm not going to do it in that voice, I promise.
Please
do. So Lizzie Benson slid into a job as a librarian without a traditional degree, but this gives her a vantage point from which to practice her other calling. She is a fake shrink. For years, she has tended to her God-haunted mother and her recovering addict brother. They have both stabilized for the moment, but Lizzie has little chance to spend her new free time with husband and son before her old mentor, Sylvia Liller, makes a proposal. She's become famous for her prescient podcast, Hell and High Water, and wants to hire Lizzie to answer the mail she receives from left-wingers worried about climate change and right-wingers worried about the decline of Western civilization. As Lizzie dives into this polarized world, she begins to wonder what it means to keep tending your own garden once you've seen the flames beyond its walls. When her brother becomes a father and Sylvia a recluse, Lizzie is forced to address the limits of her own experience, but she still tries to save everyone, using everything she's learned about empathy and despair, conscience and collusion, from her years of wandering the library stacks, and all the while the voices of the city keep floating in, funny, disturbing, and increasingly mad. That's a really long back cover blurb for a book that is less than 30,000 words.
It is such a short book. And yet it did take me a bit of time to read it.
Yes, because there's a density to those little – because it's the way it's written, which we'll get to in a sec. Mm. But what do you think of that back, that blurb? They're just not very good.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a summary. That's the book. that's the book.
Yeah, I know. I don't read them ever, and now that I'm reading them back to you, I wouldn't want to pick up Weather if I didn't know who Jenny Offal was.
And why did you pick up Weather?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for segueing into that. It was very neat.
Thanks for ruining my segue.
Yes. In 2014, she wrote an extraordinary book about the same length and written entirely the same way called Department of Speculation, which is essentially a book of auto fiction. I think that's what they call it now. So when someone writes a fictional novel, but really it's biographical. And the effect that had on me is it's a story very much about the characters dealing with a newborn and issues with her husband and trying to return to her career by writing a new book. And these things all coming together at the same time. And it's a novel that really resonated because at the time I read it in 2014, Sophie, my daughter, was 1 year old and she was a bit of a handful. And there are scenes in that book that seem to be literally torn from my life, including babies vomiting into hair and that sort of thing that Sophie was prone to do. And it just felt – and also the inability to do very much meaningful while looking after a child. And it just seemed very resonant and just on point for what I wanted. And, look, it seemed to be the case for a lot of people because it was a bestseller. It was one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 best books of the year. I think it won some awards, but I haven't checked, to be honest. It was fantastic. It's funny because the big thing about Department of Speculation was that her first novel, her first novel was Last Things, which was published in 1999, which I have not read. So it took her 15 years between that and Department of Speculations. And Last Things itself was, a notable book and all that sort of jazz. So a lot of people had been sitting on the edge of their seats waiting for her next novel, and it took 15 years for that to come. And so I suppose we're lucky that Weather has only taken 6 years, which actually it's been already shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction at Weather. And I'm expecting it to see it, despite what we might say about it in this podcast, I'm expecting to see it on the National Book Award long list at the very least in a few months.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess I can see why that would be.
I get the feeling you're going to say negative stuff about this book. I feel this coming from a mile away.
Not negative so much as I guess I'm kind of neutral about this book. Like it's not a bad book. It just didn't – I didn't really connect with the book.
I didn't connect with Hold.
There we go. But I think part of that is situational and every time you read a book it's situational to some extent. You know, no one ever reads the same book. But yeah, I don't know. I like it's a good book. It was fun to read in some ways, and I just didn't connect with it. It's not a book that would make me go out and read others of hers, put it that way. Although I do still want to read Department of Speculation because I have been meaning to read that for years, and I will eventually get to it. Her writing is lovely and elegant, and sparse, but rich. So I love the prose itself. It's just, I just didn't connect with this book. Sad.
Yeah. So the way the book's written, and this is key to this discussion, is that she writes in these, they're not fragments, they're short paragraphs of 3 to 4 sentences each, some a little bit longer, and she doesn't entirely tell a linear story. It's mostly in order, so it doesn't. Yeah, so it's got, but it's got asides to it. It goes on these minor tangents. The point is that there are a number of threads that each of those paragraphs are dealing with. So they're either dealing with the climate change stuff that she's doing with Sylvia. Mm-hmm. Yep. They're dealing with her son, They're dealing with her relationship with her husband, or they're dealing with her, probably one of the more important relationships, with her brother. And because they are these nuggets of prose, you don't ever really get into a flow with the novel, and that's deliberate. So I think the what was said about her work, especially Department of Speculation 6 years ago, is that you awful as someone you read in the white spaces, which is an extremely pretentious thing to say, but that's where her books, they do exist in the words, obviously, but they also exist in those white spaces in between, because there's a lot of white space if you actually pick up the physical copies of her books. They're deliberately well spaced out in that way. And, yeah, I can see how that would be off-putting. It depends what you're looking for, and you're right, it's situational. If you're looking for, flowing prose that tells even a nonlinear story but moves, has traditional length paragraphs and moves in that direction, this is not going to work for you because of the way it's written. But I don't think that's your problem, though. You're not saying that you had an issue with her little nuggets of gold. Because there's also a sense of humor here that you have, everyone's going to find funny.
It's a very funny book. Funny. I mean, there's a lot of dark humor in there. I apologize, listeners, for the echo that you can probably hear. We have some tech issues this episode. I'll try to get them fixed for next time. But anyway, so it wasn't the format or anything, although I think, like, the weird thing is I read this book in a week where I was, for other reasons, just really tired and not getting a lot of sleep. And one of the bad habits I've picked up, which just compounds the problem, is just to scroll through Facebook and look at things before I go to sleep, which is bad and stupid. And I know, you don't have to at me. But I had these weird kind of things, like, during the day, because I'd also read some of this book at night as well. And then when I got too tired, I'd put it aside and scroll through Facebook for another 10 hours before I actually turned off the light. But I had these weird things all the time where during the day I would I'd think of these things, and I couldn't sometimes place whether that was from weather or whether it was what someone had said on Facebook or not necessarily what someone had said, but like a little meme or post that someone had shared or whatever. And that's kind of what reading this book sort of felt like. And part of that is, the fact that she's got all these little snippets and inserts and sort of scrapbook style of adding extra content, which doesn't, it's not part of the narrative flow. It's sort of, what am I trying to think of? I can't even think of the word. It just adds to what the narrative and the narrator are talking about, but it's not part of, the narrative proper, I guess. But also the fact that even what you would think about as the narrative proper, so the narrator talking in first person, all of those bits and the story that she's telling, because she is telling a story. They're written in sort of online format. So, it's a space between each paragraph, left justified, that sort of stuff. So reading the whole thing, and I read it on a Kindle as well, so I didn't have even the difference of thinking, was I holding a book in my hand or was it all on a screen? So it was a very weird experience reading this book. And that's part of, I think, the disconnection that I felt. I never connected to the idea of reading a book. It all just felt like reading stuff online, which kind of made me think how disconnected I actually must feel just scrolling through Facebook, and I should probably stop. I did. I went off Facebook for a year, and I should do it again.
So I wonder how much of that is the subject matter of the book, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think that fed into it. Like, so
consider where we're at right this second.
Yeah.
Okay. We're at, in Victoria, where we both live. Mm. Well, you're not, but I am in lockdown. So you've escaped lockdown because of where you are.
We're still in stage two restrictions, though. It's not like we can do everything or anything. We just don't have the stay-at-home lockdown that you guys in Melbourne have.
Yes. Although when I read this, I don't think we'd started lockdown yet. But, I mean, still, the numbers were beginning to spike.
Yeah.
And this book is about climate change. Funnily enough, we just did a podcast on climate change.
I know, right?
And completely coincidental. I mean, it's called Weather, but that doesn't necessarily – I mean, the previous book's called Department of Speculation, which sounds like a fantasy novel. Mm. So, I didn't know that Weather was actually going to be about climate change, but it is, and end of world times. Mm. So, well, that's the other thing. It's very, the conversations that are being had in the novel are very much the conversations we're hearing right now, not necessarily because of climate change, but because of the pandemic. That sort of survivalist mentality.
I think that's part of the thing that irritated me, actually. I'm just going to keep comparing it to Facebook. It's a really highbrow literary analysis happening here. But, you know, surprise, surprise, we all live in kind of little bubbles online a lot of the time. You know, not everybody in my feed is my friend or even someone I know. Like I try to get a range of input into my social media feeds, but it's still obviously quite limited and quite bubbly. So seeing a whole bunch of posts all the time from people, you know, and a lot of it is gallows humor, right? All of the end times thing and what can we expect from July and blah blah blah, and I've done some of it myself, but it's all just really like it's not the end of the world. Like, it's especially not the end of the world for us. Oh dear, we can't go to a restaurant and have a nice meal. Like, oh, whoa is me, right? Oh dear, we've had to walk all of our same streets 10 times because we can't leave our suburb. I mean, it's not actually end time stuff for us. And I think part of what was irritating me about the narrator of this book is that what irritated her about me is what irritates me about me. You know, yeah. She's in this bubble where it's you know, it is the end of the world, like big picture it is, but it's not affecting her. Like, it's not. Like, she's got a really nice house to live in. She's the stuff which is affecting her life is not actually the big climate change. It's something that will affect her, and it's something that, you know, is going to affect the planet and humanity in a big picture thing. But she gets to think about, well, I'm going to have a doomstead in New Zealand and it's going to, you know, there is this kind of...
Well, no, but are you confusing her with Sylvia? Because Sylvia...
No, Lizzie spends a lot of time fantasizing about her doomsday that she's going to get.
She fantasizes, but I don't think she thinks she can afford to do any of that.
No, she doesn't. But that's kind of her fantasy. Her fantasy is, well, we'll just get away with just me and a few people I care about, and we'll just ride it out, and we'll do the best we can. Instead of like, well, maybe we'll do something a bit better for everybody. Like, you know what I mean? It's this idea, and look, I have the same idea. It's like, yeah, wouldn't it be great to just get some place that's safe and high altitude and, you know, set yourself up and live off the grid and blah, blah, blah. And how does that help anyone except me, maybe, if I can do it?
So I think what's irritating you about the novel is actually the point of the novel.
I know.
And that sometimes happens. So, and look, so a couple of things. One, Sylvia, she gets to run away because she's financially... self-sufficient. Yeah. I've just run out of words. So she gets to run, and I think the novel acknowledges that she's able to move elsewhere. Absolutely. In fact, she's able to shut down her podcast because she gets Lizzie to answer her fan mail. Mm-hmm. It's usually the ravings of lunatics. And some of the funniest bits of the novel are the responses that Lizzie gives to some of the which is, yes, that's the Facebook bit in a sense. Yeah. That's the stuff that I know probably bugged you, but why laugh?
That was funny bits.
But Sylvie gets to go. She gets to leave. She gets to run away and go to the high altitudes areas I think she goes to a homestead somewhere and starts, you know, tending her garden. And I think that's actually in the blurb. But anyway, she gets to run away, whereas Lizzie is stuck in Brooklyn, you know, and she has responsibilities. And yes, she fantasizes, you're right. Mm. But because I read a bit around the book, and Offal talks about how she was grappling with why climate change was something she understood intellectually but not emotionally. And that's what this book is trying to grapple with.
I think the book does it really well. The book presents, you know, this mindset of at one time living with, you know, the knowledge of what is happening on a global scale and what that is going to mean in decades and significantly less than decades for some people, and knowing that as fact and knowing that, you know, there are some things you can do but a lot of things you can't do, and living with that knowledge at the same time as having to deal with all of the day-to-day crises and personal disasters that are impacting you, that need to be addressed with now. Like, they need to be done now. It's like, have you seen it's a quadrant chart of sort of how to prioritize things, and there's things which are urgent and things which are non-urgent, and then things which are important and things which are not important. And so if you picture it as four quarters, and you've got things that are important and urgent, important and not urgent, unimportant but urgent, unimportant and not urgent. And we spend way too much of our time doing the unimportant, urgent things. And, you know, a significant amount of time doing the important, urgent things, but almost no time doing the important, non-urgent things. And that's the issue. We get caught up in those two quadrants of varying importance, but everything that seems to need to be done now, and we don't have enough time or mental bandwidth to think about the things which are really important, but, you know, there doesn't seem to be an urgency about them. I mean, I would argue that the whole climate issue does have an urgency about it. We just don't – we can't manage to see that.
Okay, but wouldn't you argue that this book – coincidentally, given what we said in the last podcast about the two books we spoke about there, Flight Behaviour and Overstory, which we both said, oh, well, at least I did, I complained that that these books don't work to convince anyone that there's an issue here. Mm. Probably neither does Weather, because it's only 30,000 words and it's probably only going to be read by us.
Weather is speaking to a very specific audience who do not need to be convinced and possibly just need to be comforted that this
But it's addressing that question though.
Yeah.
So I think the answer that she gives is, well, if you've got a brother who's a drug addict, and you've got a husband who's sort of not estranged, but you've got a weird relationship, and if you're focusing on your child and blah blah blah, and all these daily, some of them tragic, some of them, you know, in that quadrant that you were speaking of, that yes, you lose the grip, unless you're answering emails from crazy people, you lose grip on the issues around climate change. I think that's what this book is trying to
present. Yeah, and I think it does that well. Like, as I said, it presents that mindset very well.
Yeah, I mean, look, to me, it's a book that loses puff in the last quarter.
It does.
Because once you get because it is very funny, it's clearly a book that's not going to tie any threads up. So there are minor bits around her brother and there are minor bits around her son and even her marriage. But it's because it's set at the time of Trump's election, which I have to say is actually handled really. There's this uneasiness that runs through it around Trump's election, which I thought was really good. But because of that, it doesn't end anywhere, and that's maybe there's probably a million literary novels that do that too. But so to me, it lost a bit of its punch because it doesn't feel like a whole. It feels like an open-ended question.
It does. It feels exactly like starting to scroll through Facebook and after an hour or so stopping. And you've just dipped in and done that for a little bit and dipped out again. If Facebook was written this well, I'd never get off Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't – it was a very easy, like, as a funny, well-written, beautifully written, actually. Like, the voice of Lizzie is just on point. And I wasn't irritated with Lizzie or with anything in particular. It's just, like, I didn't connect to the book. And it was just like, yep, I get it. Yep, I know this. Yep. And I don't know, nothing in the book – I don't know, sparked any sort of new thought or new, which is what a good book should do, you know, like it should make you think differently. It should make you aware of something you weren't aware of, another perspective, another point of view, another way life is lived. And this book which doesn't make it a bad book. It just
I understand that, but I do.
It's not a book I connected with. And I suspect a lot for its target readership, it's not going to present them with anything new either.
Yeah, so I disagree with you on that.
Okay.
Because I think it is trying to do something that literary fiction or fiction generally is not doing very well at the moment, which is understand why we're struggling to deal with this issue of climate change and what it is that's, you know, what's holding us back at a very human level, not at a budgetary government.
Yeah.
Macro level, but at a very intimate level. I do want to read a couple of passages because I do want to show how funny this book is,
okay,
but also how she is so biting and gut-punching in just the use of one sentence. So this bit here is, again, her son. This is she's had a yelling match with her young son. Mm-hmm. A few days later, I yelled at him, that's her son, for losing his new lunchbox, and he turned to me and said, "Are you sure you're my mother? Sometimes you don't seem like a good enough person. He was just a kid, so I let it go. And now, years later, I probably only think of it, I don't know, once or twice a day." Because that is so true. There are things that my kids have said that I know every day just going to – they haunt you. They never go away. You know, this is the one I love the most. Can I just – I actually could read huge chunks of this book out aloud. I'm not going to because that would be silly and we don't have that much time. But this one I love. Later, Sylvia tells me her end of the table – so this is they're at a dinner party because Sylvia goes out with all these academics and all these really smart people, and it's – and Sylvia herself is an academic. Later, Sylvia tells me her end of the table was even worse. The guy in the Gore-Tex jacket was going on and on about transhumanism and how he would soon shed these burdensome bodies and become part of the singularity. These people long for immortality but can't wait 10 minutes for a cup of coffee, she says. I think we know people like that.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's very good. Like there are a lot of these asides and observations and things. They're funny. The book is not uninteresting to read. It's not – it's just – yeah,
but it's a 30,000-word book that you read in a week. It should have taken you one day.
Did I mention how tired I was?
No. That's my point.
I only kind of read it.
We're about to talk about Hold, and you know how long Hold took me to read?
A week.
The exact same problem, and it's not a long book either. It's 50,000 words. I know words because my thing counts.
It's funny the things that because I was looking through the bits I highlighted in Weather, and it's not those funny bits. I guess it's the more. I don't know, the more poignant sort of things. And there's two that I really, really liked. And one was talking about – I'll just read it. There is a period after every disaster in which people wander around trying to figure out if it is truly a disaster. Disaster psychologists use the term milling to describe most people's default actions when they find themselves in a frightening new situation. And I love that little nugget. That was really nice because milling, I think, is what a lot of us are doing right now. We're trying to figure out what the situation is. Is it a disaster? If it is, what do we do? If it's not, are we overreacting? Blah, blah, blah. And there was another bit which I can't find at the moment, but she was talking to Will, who's the war journalist, and she was asking him...
The one that she has a thing for.
Yeah, the one she almost but doesn't has an affair with. And she was asking him in regards to, I guess, early Trumpian America, if you know, in his experience of reporting from war zones, if this... felt like the beginning of a war, and he said, "Well, it more feels like the period before a war, like something in the atmosphere, something in the something in the weather, like something in just the people are feeling." And I'm thinking, "Wow, this book, you know, was released earlier this year, but obviously written before then." And it's like that struck such a chord with me because that's kind of what a lot of the world feels like now. Like there is, we are just pre. Something even worse, and that may not be what happens, but it kind of, I guess, echoed that feeling, or not echoed, it kind of identified that feeling that I have a lot of the time, and I think a lot of people have right now, that we're just sort of pre something really, really bad. And so
let's end on that note and move to the next
book.
But that's what the whole book is about.
Being in this space where shit is happening, but it's not so bad. You can't, for some of us who are privileged enough, live your normal life with some changes, and yet there's just this, I guess, feeling of ominous dread that it's about to get really bad. And we don't know what that's going to look like or what we can do about it. And that's the whole of Weather, I think, that kind of encapsulates the whole of the book. This is what the book is about. Like, we're living in this time now and it's not good, but it's going to get worse and we don't know what to do about that.
So if you want to read the Facebook of novels...
so it's easier just to read Facebook, right, than to try to figure out what to fucking do about it.
No. Look, it's not as good as Department of Speculation. And certainly Department of Speculation got to me more than this book did. But this book has a lot going for it. And I think it's beautifully written.
It absolutely is.
I think people get some – well, joy is probably not the right word, but enjoyment.
Validation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. But as Kirsten
and
said –
And not in a, like, keep going, you're doing well, thumbs up validation, but just a validation of how you might be feeling in the world at the moment. And I see you, this is how you're feeling. It is a real thing. But the next step, I guess, is to figure out how to get out of that space.
And there is a link at the very end of the book, and you would have found it on your Kindle as well, to a website that provides tips for activism.
Yeah.
So, and I'll just read out the website, www.obligatorynotofhope.com. It's a pretty decent, I looked at it. It's a pretty well curated website. It's worth having a look at.
Cool.
Yes. Okay. On that note.
That was weather.
That was weather. I recommend it. Kirsten says read Facebook instead.
I did not say that. Stop putting words in my mouth.
Yeah, pretty much did. You want to introduce the second book?
Hold, yes. This is a book that I've been meaning to read for ages. I think, if I remember correctly, which I make absolutely no claims to, I may have had it recommended on the Cood Street podcast. I think James Bradley was a guest and he recommended this book. That's my memory. It may not be accurate. I'm sorry, James, if that's not the case.
It might have been because he's actually mentioned in the acknowledgements.
Oh, there you go. But it's written by Kirsten Tranter, and I'll read the blurb. Why not? That's what we do now. 3 years ago, Shelley's lover, Conrad, died in a surfing accident. Now, still in a state of subdued grief, Shelley has just moved into an old Victorian terrace in Paddington with David, her new partner, trying for a new beginning. At home one morning, Shelley discovers a door to a small, intriguing room, which is not on the plans. There is a window, a fireplace, and a beautiful chandelier, but nothing else. When Shelley meets a man who seems to be Conrad's uncanny double, the mysterious room begins to dominate her world, becoming a focus for her secret fantasies and fears, offering escape, which also threatens to become a trap. Yeah, I'm going to leave that there.
That's actually a decent blurb.
It's not too bad. What a good blurb does is entice you to read the book without telling you what the book's wholly about or how you should feel about the book.
Yes.
And yeah. I think the other one does it really well. It's a really nice setup.
Trans new novel is a meditation on grief and loss. And
it did go on a little bit about that, but I left that last sentence off.
Oh, you left that? Ah.
It's only one sentence, though, just talking about how good it is. They all do that.
Does it actually say meditation?
Oh, God, I'll read it. Fine, I'll read it. A waking dream of a novel hold is spellbinding, sensual and unsettling. There you go. It's not too bad.
Okay.
But it's a really good, I guess, like teaser. Like that's what the blurb should be. It'd be like, here's this really interesting setup. Now read the book. And I really liked Hold. I really liked reading it. I really connected with Shelley. It's another first person narrative. And I liked it. I liked the uncertainty of this book. And I like the fact that it refused to provide... Yeah, it didn't collapse any possibilities. It refused to provide any answers about what these strange things were doing or what they meant. And I really liked that.
I agree with you. I think that's the best parts of the book, that it when we come to the room, it deliberately sits on the fence. Could be just a room that's missing from the plans, or could be a anomaly in the space-time vortex. It could be the House of Leaves, or just a room that – it just happens to be there.
I mean, it's definitely not the same room.
Yeah, and I like how it shifts that. Depending on her mood and depending on where she's at, that shifts.
Mm.
I really enjoy that. That to me, that subtlety, it was extraordinary. That was brilliant.
I mean, the room appears to have its own sentience, its own agenda and motives for doing like.
Plays that in such a way that could all be in her head.
It could be absolutely. But if you take it as not, which is how I choose to read it, like it's quite extraordinary that the room has its own. It's built up as its own character in the novel, and it does things and knows things and wants things that we aren't privy to, and it does what it does. Like the room is my favorite part of this book. I love that room.
And it is my favorite part, but
surprising, Larry. It's the core of, like, it is what the book is about. The book is about room.
But I still didn't connect with it.
Why not?
Look, because I found everything outside of the room to be a little been there, done that. I've read this sort of story before. And I know the room is what adds that spice. I get that. And I'm not saying my argument here is particularly well thought out. But the fact that she's not married to, but she's with a fairly dreadful human being of a man who is, yes, he came to her at a time of need after the You know, she. The story is that, you know, her previous partner dies, drowns. Mm. She's struggling to come to terms with that loss, and she has met him. David, I think his name is. Yeah, she's met him, but she's sort of drifting out of the world. She's distanced herself from everyone, and he sort of comes in and sweeps her up and gets her to engage back with the world. But other than that nice thing that he did, which might have just been for himself anyway, because he seems to be that sort of guy, he's a pretty awful person. And
he's a pretty ordinary person.
Well,
I don't think he's – like one of the things I liked about Hold is that they didn't portray David as this – because it's a very – we'll just get it out up front. It's a very gothic book, like capital G gothic book. And it's contemporary, but it draws very heavily and makes a lot of connections back to gothic literature. And it's a really good example of the contemporary gothic, actually. But they didn't make David, you know, like a big gothic villain. He's not. He's kind of like you could make him kind of akin to Rochester from Jane Eyre. Like he's done bad things, but he's not even as bad as Rochester, you know, locking his wife in an attic and like just keeping her prisoner. He's just very common. I mean, like he clearly cares about Shelley in his own way. He's not, you know, he's not abusive. He's not. He's what he is, and yeah, he has an affair, but so does she. And
well,
yeah,
he is,
like,
he's
just very. He's just
a
commonly
gaslight and all that. But
he's just very common. Like he's not like an evil person. He's just he's not a great person.
No.
But like, no. She hasn't, like, Tranter hasn't made him this person that you really hate and you want. Like, he's just kind of there.
Him.
Really?
I was very dismissive
of him.
Because of the passive-aggressive nature of him, because he chooses the furniture. Because when she sees the beautiful red sofa, she knows she can't. If she bought it and actually put it in the house, not the room, he'd lose the plot.
Absolutely.
This constant gaslighting and negging and that. Yes, I get that he's not out and out evil. And you see, he's having an affair with her best friend.
Yeah.
Which we find out later, spoilers. but he isn't out and out evil.
Yeah. And I think that's what I meant. Like, he's not a good person, but he's not. He's. I could.
But I think I hate him all the more for being someone who could, if he just tweaked a few things, could be a decent human being. I think I hate him all the more. That's the thing. The thing that got me isn't so much the affair; it's how he deals with Shelley over his daughter's rape, I suppose, in a sense, because she's underage, of her ballet teacher and the abortion and what Shelley knew and when she knew it. I mean, when she knew it. You know, there's like 5 hours that have passed before she tells him because Janie wants the daughter to tell her father, which makes perfect sense. And he loses it. You knew all this time and you never told. And I just think, okay, I really didn't like him, but at that point I hated him. And look, that's the point.
I think that's it's funny because it's not a great reaction he has, but it's a really understandable one. I think the portrait of David is really – it's actually really nuanced because he's not this – you don't agree?
No, I hear you and I'll let you speak, but I'll just say it out. I don't.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Because he's not this cardboard cartoony villain. He's not – like he's not a nice person, but he's also not like a horrendous person. And what I think Tranter does really well with that relationship between Shelley and David is she does set up quite elegantly how Shelley has gotten into this relationship and why she's staying. Because David is like his controlling behaviours that he exhibits, you know, they're there and to an extent they're something that enables Shelley to just continue on in her sort of well of grief that she hasn't climbed out of despite what people around her might think. And she gets to let him actually make all the decisions and do everything, and she gets to remain very insular. And it's only at the end where she has found a way to begin to emerge from that she realises she doesn't actually need someone like that in her life, and you know, she can begin to exercise her own agency again and start to think about the world outside herself again. Yeah. And so she's just going to go. And she does. Like, it's not a great relationship, but I think for Shelley, part of that for her at the time is it's what enables her to not move on, and that's what she where she wants to be at that point. So yeah, and obviously the relationship with David at the time the novel begins is already beginning to slightly chafe, perhaps. And it's so interesting that that's when she discovers the room. But yeah, I don't feel David is drawn in. He's not even drawn in a way that feels threatening. Like, at no point did I feel he was ever a threat to Shelley. He was. I could kind of dismiss him.
Not violent, but I think he's whittled her down and shaped her as he wants psychologically. So it depends.
See, I just felt her psyche. Look, her psyche was a lot stronger than that. I think what's whittled her down is her inability to actually move past Conrad. You know,
yes.
Like, I don't, and I think her relationship with David has supported that, and certainly hasn't actually helped her get away from that. But yeah, I think the reason I could dismiss David so easily as not as a character in his own right, but as any kind of, I guess, driver in the novel was that I never felt at any time he was ever a threat to Shelley, like in any way. Like, I don't even feel when she does go, he's going to even put up a fight about dividing the house or anything, and neither does she. And I just don't think he's that type of a person. He's there to sort of enable her continued insularity and her continued, you know, the way she has shut down. And he thinks he's rescued her from that, but he's actually just continued to enable her to do that. And what the room does is open that to her. And the room... Yeah, the room has its own agenda. I love that room so much.
Yeah, no. Look, I agree with you. Mm. I agree with you. And, yeah, even if he doesn't – I don't think he ever finds out about the affair she has with the Conrad facsimile. And if he had I don't imagine he would have – he would have got angry. He would have been furious. But I don't imagine he would have hit her or anything like that. In fact, if anything, he would have just sulked away, maybe he's gone on a long trip or who knows. But – He's not an overtly violent person in that sense.
Or abusive in other ways. Really.
At the end of the day, look, here's the truth.
Yeah, okay.
Here's the real truth. Okay? There is a delicacy to this novel and to the prose that maybe 6 months ago I'd have loved, that right now is washing over me. And that's really what this is about.
Okay.
Okay, so I can use the excuse that I didn't like particularly their character, but I mean that's actually the point. It really comes down to just like you. I read mostly late at night, and it requires. And I'm not going to say muscular prose because I know that first of all it's a horrible thing to say, and I know how much you hate it. But and it's not true anyway. It's just that there's certain types of novels that at this moment are just not going to work for my brain. They're not going to connect with me. And this book is not sedate or dull, but it is so delicate at times and subtle in voice that the words just blurred in front of me at times.
Yeah, look, I'd agree with that, but that's part of the genre in which it's writing.
No, I get that. No, this is not a fault of this is it's me, not you.
It's why you're not connected.
Yeah. So, and I'm not asking Kirsten to go back in time and add more, you know, aggressive sentences and more exclamation marks
more
and
grittiness.
Have an explosion in there somewhere, or have, you know, someone shoot someone. That's not what I'm. No, the book is what it is, and for what it is, it's. Oh, look, I love the room, but even see, this is the thing. Intellectually, I love the idea of the room not being one thing or the other, and depending on her moods depends on how you treat the room. But that also, and it wasn't a frustration, but it also seemed like, you know, my brain's going, okay. As much as emotionally is what, that's not my brain. My heart is emotionally going, my brain's going, genius. And I don't know how to. I don't know how to marry those two together, and I think that's just this moment. And I think this is going to be the problem with this podcast going forward as we sit in pandemic world.
I was actually thinking about this last night when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about. I really don't have a problem with us or anyone actually talking about a very, very subjective response to books. Because I think we're kind of kidding ourselves if we think, you know, even as critics, we can really ever be objective about whether or not a book is good and whether or not it's working, because we're really only talking about whether or not the book is working for us at that time that we read it. And yeah, obviously you can bring in knowledge of where the book connects in literature and where it fits in the author's work, and you can make all of these comparisons, and obviously that's part of the job of the critic. But at base, it's, you know, we can't really ever lose sight of the fact that our reading of any book at any time is highly subjective. And I'm absolutely on board to talk about that aspect of things as well. So... I don't have a problem with that going forward, and just acknowledging that, hey, we're reading these books at certain times, and, you know, our reading of it is going to be different to what it was. It's like when we, you know, the first one, not the first one, but the first proper one, where we just picked a couple of old books that we'd read, or that, you know, one of us had read a while ago, and we can talk about how different the book is now. Like, it is a different book to read now than it was 15 years ago when we first read it. And the book itself, like the words on the paper haven't changed. But that other, the other link, that's only one part of what a book is. The other part is how the reader.
So, for example, with the Minotaur book, I didn't notice the ending 15 years ago. This time around, it hit me in the face.
Yeah. And like Skin, I loved Skin both times I read it, but for different reasons and in different ways.
Yeah.
And so I'm more than happy to talk about that going forward, and to acknowledge that this subjectivity is part of it. And like I said, with Weather, part of the particular week that I read Weather and what else was happening in my life at that time. And if I hadn't also scanned through Facebook for an hour after I read the bit of the book every night, I wouldn't have had that blurring, melding. And is that the book's fault? No, but also it's part of the experience of reading that book. We read a book not in isolation, but in concert with the rest of our lives, and that's how it shapes our reception of that book and our interpretation of that book. Going back to Hold, I was enjoying the book, right? I was enjoying the book. It was good. I liked the voice. I liked Tranter's prose. I liked the constant little, I guess, echoes of Gothic literature and how that is often written. And as I said, it's an excellent example of contemporary Gothic. It's such a good book. And what I loved about it is when you get to, I think it feels like about the two-thirds point when Shelley finally goes into her neighbour's house, because she's in a twin terrace, Victorian terrace, and one of the reasons she doesn't know whether the room exists or if it does exist, who owns the room, is because it doesn't appear to be part of their footprint. It appears to be kind of in her neighbour's house, or yes, should be. But so when she finally actually goes into her neighbour's house, or is invited in, and like her neighbour, I can't remember, what's Robin, is it Robin? I can't remember the wife's name. No, the husband is Rob. Anyway.
I think it starts with A. I've forgotten as well, sorry.
Anyway, when she finally goes and she gets taken up into their version of that room, and it's not even sure whether, like, they have a room as well, but is it the same room? Like, is it the same physical space? And Shelley doesn't know, and the book never comes down on one side or the other. It feels to me it's the same space, but the room changes itself depending on who's in there. And the room, I look at the room because it's described as, like, it's got dark red damask wallpaper. It's actually, the room is kind of red. You think of the room as a red room, and even the chaise-longue that Shelley buys to go in the room is red velvet, and it's almost the same colour as the damask wallpaper. And I kind of just thought about this room as a wound in this white, minimalist, stark house that is Shelley's. Her neighbour's house is not as stark. It's more of a cluttered artist-type house. But where Shelley lives with David, it's very stark and white and steel and minimalist and all of that sort of aesthetic. So this, in the middle of this house, this room is this sort of red, wet, literally wet on one night, wound that is just
That's
not
the best thing in the novel, by the way.
You know, not healing. And it's so for Shelley, it's not healing. For her neighbours who've lost a daughter,
Who lived in the room,
it's a wound that also isn't healing. But it's more than that. It's not something that the inhabitants of these two houses, to me, doesn't feel like they're putting that onto the room. It feels like this is the room, as I said, has its own sentience and its own agenda.
So we find out that the next door neighbours, their daughter, lived in the room. Mm. It's that sinister aspect of the room that I actually hadn't felt prior to knowing that, because the daughter has run away, has gone missing.
Yeah.
And you feel, well, is it the room that repelled the daughter? What's, you know, what's
or is the daughter's absence?
Just like it's rejecting Shelley. Yeah. Is that what's?
And is the daughter's absence what created the room? Like, has her absence from the room made it what it is? Like, so it's not just a room anymore. It's something else. Like, is the loss and the grief. And this is what I loved about it, the novel became so infinitely more complex once it revealed, I guess, that it's not just Shelley's room. Other people have access to this room. This room predated Shelley and not even predated her, even the previous inhabitants of her terrace, perhaps. You know, like, yep. It's not her room. She's the interloper here. It's someone else's room. It's someone else's grief and someone else's wound that she's come into. And it's so fascinating to think about that. And I guess the idea of if you're feeling, and this is why there are support groups and so on around people who are undergoing a grief, that you do get supported in that grief by other people, but you can also get trapped in that grief if you're stuck with other people who are also not moving out of that space.
I think that's what was great, that the room itself has some therapeutic benefits for Shelley, but it isn't the solution. If she needs to grow out of, leave the room. I don't think it has. I loved all that stuff. That's what engaged me when I was, because I did finish, I mean, I read the novel. That stuff engaged me. That got to me. It's when it got to the more tawdry, he says in scare quotes. You know, even the affair with the Conrad clone.
Isn't the Conrad clone weird?
Yeah,
Like even the furniture shop where she meets him because he works in that furniture shop where she buys the Shay. But then it's never open again. She can never get back to it. Sometimes she can't find it, and then whenever she does find it, everything's closed. And the one time I think she goes there when it is open, these other people are there, so she doesn't go in. It's like the shop and the room are kind of connected. But again, there's nothing that's ever resolved about that. I love this book so much for its refusal to resolve any of these things, because the resolution of any of those things could only have been a disappointment.
Yes. Oh, 100% agree. 100% agree.
And I love that, because what you want resolved in this book is not, what does the room mean? Is Conrad real or not? None of that matters. And as I said, it would only be a disappointment for any of that to be resolved. What matters is Shelley. And whether or not she's going to get out of...
Do you mean whether the Conrad clone is real?
I don't know. I don't know if he is. He's manifest in some way, whether he's a real person or not, or whether he's some... You know, the room wanted that couch. Did the room make all that stuff happen to get the couch? Like, I don't know, and I don't want to know. I don't care. I'm happy to sit with all of that uncertainty, because really at base...
Because you're tilting in a very firm direction here, Kirsten, that the room is a supernatural.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not.
You think it's all in Shelley's head?
There is a room.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that I think that Tranter does a really good job in not tilting in that direction, and it's only what we give, what we put to it. So if we come from a genre background, we feel just that we need to give that sort of framework to the room. But I actually deliberately, maybe partly to engage myself a bit more into the novel, because like I said, I was losing the thread at some points. I deliberately didn't want to see it that way. I wanted to see it as just a room that happened that just isn't on the plan. And yeah, it's weird that it seems that where the room is doesn't make sense in the general, you know, the land use around that area, but that it is still just a room. And look, I get that it might be supernatural, but I actually fought that idea.
Okay. So how about night with all the water?
There's a leak.
But it's all gone. It's not cleaned up. It's not.
So the room, it gets into the carpet. It's parquetry, isn't it? The floor is parquetry.
Up until that point, I think you can go, it might all be how Shelley's perceiving the room. Then you either are going, Shelley either hallucinated or imagined that event, or there's something else.
It's raining outside when this happens.
The room floods. She is soaked. and there's water everywhere. She's worried about the whole house flooding. There's that much water in the room.
Well, maybe it's got great drainage. Okay, fair enough. Look, yes, I love. I just said before when I interrupted you that is my favourite scene in the book.
Yeah, right.
It's great because it is. It's like there's the room is crying.
It's kind of the turning point to how. Like for Shelley, I think it's a turning point.
I gritted my teeth, though, Kirsten. I fought it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want, and the book, and look, to its credit, it never is resolved, but I didn't want there to be even that sort of thing that you could hang your hat on at all. I wanted it to be completely on the fence.
Hey, you could still have that. It just means that you're have to make the assumption then that Shelley has imagined a lot of that stuff.
Which is not fair to Shelley as a character because it takes away her agency and to a degree.
Well, no, it's just an additional manifestation of her grief. I mean, yeah. I think you can still definitely take the line that this is all, like there is nothing at all remotely unnatural about the room or anything else. And it's all how Shelley reacts to it. And yeah, I mean, as I said, the book doesn't really come down either way. I think I'm more than happy to say there is something off kilter about the room and to regard the room as a character with its own motives and its own agenda and its own story that we aren't privy to, really.
Yeah, but there are things like – and this might be part – actually, backs your point. So we know the topography of the room is weird, okay, it's okay. It actually didn't occur to me that the room is upstairs.
Yeah, it's upstairs. Yeah.
So it's literally a barnacle sticking off the front of the back of the house or the back of the terrace. The fact that she's put it upstairs makes it even weirder.
But it's in between. It's not off. It's in between.
Yes,
like,
no, I know.
Like it's a long sliver.
And there's a window
between.
As well, and the window looks out on the weird sculptures, which we haven't spoken about. In fact, if anything, the freakiest thing in this whole novel is the sculptures
that Rob makes. That,
yeah, yeah. Because they seem to grow, but they don't. That's it.
Yeah, like I mean, there is so much unresolved.
The more I talk about this, the more clearly it becomes. Rob talked to you about it. I was talking to someone else who would. Anyway, but. I was going to say, yeah, she doesn't notice at any point until she goes to the next door neighbor's house that there is a door that connects the two rooms because, on either
well,
side.
Is it hidden in the fire? Like the other door is hidden behind the fireplace. Like how gothic is that? Gothic as fuck.
Yes, I know. But yes, and it's hidden.
Yeah.
But she didn't clearly look that hard.
I feel like that sort of only
appears, so to speak, because she's gone to the next door neighbours. It's the feature sort of gets added. I don't know. I don't.
But the fireplace has always been there. It's like the fireplace is a hidden door. So I don't think. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be checking fireplaces to see if they're a hidden door. Like it, I don't know, a little fireplace. I don't know.
But how does it hide a door?
Well, it's behind it. Like it opens.
And obviously it doesn't open out, it opens in.
Opens into the room, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I am terrible with geography and geometry. Okay. So when people describe stuff in books, unless it's crystal, I sort of get confused.
And I think it wasn't dwelt on because you weren't meant to know.
Is she hurtling over the fireplace when she opens
it? No, she opens like if you pick – the way I pictured it, the way I think it is that the whole fireplace is false. And it's just a door, and you just it's like a, you know, if you see in
It's like a drawing of a fireplace on the back of
a drawing, like it's made, it's physical.
Yeah, but
it may not be a working fireplace, or it may be, but it's an artifice that opens as a door, like if you open, like you know, you get one of those bookcases that there's a room behind you, open the whole bookcase that is the door.
Yes, idiot.
That's
I know.
That's how I kind of imagined it.
How could I not? Yes, yeah, I thought obviously this is true. I thought the fireplace was a freestanding fire. Well, it's obviously against a wall, but
how
that it was
a freestanding. It's a chimney. Anyway, so I was quite happy in my head to feel that the room, there is something unnatural about the room and there is all of that. And what the lack of resolution that I really liked was just the refusal to tell the reader what it was and what it meant. I like that because it leaves me free to think about what the room does mean in the context of the novel, in the context of Shelley. And as I said, just opening that up because you're thinking about what the room means in Shelley's context and what it's doing and its behaviour in regards to Shelley, and that's how you're trying to come to terms with it and imagine it and think through what the book is doing with it. And then suddenly it's not just Shelley's room. And in fact, it predated Shelley. And what does this even mean? And I love that. It became, as I said, an infinitely more complex book. I don't think I would have loved the book anywhere near as much if it didn't have that element and if it was just Shelley and the room and everything else happened the way it happened, and but no one else had access to that room. I would not have loved this book as much. It would have felt a lot more just like, oh, yeah, that's a gothic trope you're using. But the way she's used it with these two interlinking people who share this room and the wound that it is. I love it. I just think that is so complex. I'd really love to read it again with all of that known and just, yeah, I it's a really good book. I loved it so much.
And this is why I do this podcast with the five-year gap in between. I do it because, A, you explain features in the story. You surely wouldn't have been an outline of a door, at least, to show that.
I think it's a faux fireplace. Or if it's really clever, it's a working fireplace with a faux architecture that allows it to be opened.
Yeah. And obviously flush, because there would have been a crack. Anyway, yeah. Yes. So, yes, you explain really important things like that, and I embarrass myself, just like I did with that China Mayville book, City in the City. That this is another example of that, just not as bad. But I knew going into this podcast, because I knew I didn't connect with this book as much, I knew you would have.
Yeah. It's a Kirsten book.
And I knew that in talking to you, I would enjoy it more,
which is
probably not great in terms of, because if I didn't talk to you, but that's part of this experience for me.
Well, it should, you know what?
Because really, I basically only do this for myself. I don't do it for the audience or anything like that. I do it so I can.
But it is part of the experience, or it can be part of the experience of reading a book, and that's why book clubs are so popular, and that's why, you know, people read each other's book blogs and all of that sort of stuff, because part of it is that, okay, you come to this stack of paper or Kindle or whatever, and you read it, and you have your personal experience of reading that book and what it means and how you've decoded those words and this thing that exists between you and the author of the book, which is what. Not what the author intended, can't ever be really what the author intended exactly, but this thing exists in this space. But then everyone else has had a slightly different experience of that book as well. And so when you talk to other people who've read the book about your shared but completely separate experiences, it's almost like a different book exists again. Like, I love the idea of this infinite library of the same book. And yeah, your perceptions of the book can change in retrospect. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's part of the process of reading in community, is to, not just get an interpretation of what someone else has written, but to also understand how other people have come to that book and what their experience of the book is and what your shared experience actually, can mean. I think that's part of it. It's a huge part of it.
And on that profound note, because frankly, I'm not going to say anything smart about that. Let's move on to the in bit of the podcast.
Yes.
Yes. So we are next week.
Month. We actually, next month.
Next
week. Don't put it for a week. Oh, my God. I would die.
Yeah. Okay. Next episode, that's a safer way of putting it, we're doing two horror novels. One that I actually have read and reviewed for Locus, but I didn't choose it. These were both chosen by Kirsten. I've actually read one of them, and so I'm very happy that we're doing it, because I think we're going to have an awesome conversation about it. I probably should name the books.
That would be a really good idea.
Yeah. So one of them is The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones, which, first off, has been getting rave reviews all over, both mainstream and genre places. I did order it, and I noticed that I don't think it's released in Australia yet. So.
No, so I actually need to, like, it's a semi-demi apology, because it seems like I've been hearing about, what's the second book, Ian?
Oh, Mexican, well, no, finish your.
No, it's about both of them, so second book.
Okay, and the second book is Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno-Garcia, which I've read. I've reviewed in Locus. That review actually is online, so people can read it and you can find spoilers, what I think of the book ahead of time.
Yeah. And so my slight apology is that I feel like I've been just hearing about these books for months, obviously pre-release chatter and buzz and so on, and just just feels like they've been everywhere for months. And I went, you know what, let's just read these two because, again, they'd come up just recently in my feeds or whatever. And I didn't realise they were such new releases. So Mexican Gothic was just a release this month, I believe. And The Only Good Indians, yeah, isn't actually getting released until the end of this month. So they're very new books. So I do apologise for people. We will probably be, as usual, be kind of doing spoilers. So if you haven't been able to get a hold of them before you listen to the podcast, completely forgive you if you decide to put this podcast off for a couple of months until you have a hold of those books because they are actually pretty new. I'm not even going to be getting Jones until...
The Only Good Indians on Kindle comes out on the 28th of July.
Yeah, so I'm not even going to be getting that for another few days. So,
and we're recording this, just so people know, on the 25th. Yeah. You won't hear it until the first week of August, but we're recording on the 25th of July. And Mexican Gothic came out. And for me, it's confusing because I reviewed it.
I know, like you get an advanced copy. And like I said, I've been kind of seeing buzz about these books for, it feels like a few months.
It came out 30th of June. So I'm sorry, but people have had plenty of time to read it. So 30th of June it came out, yeah.
30th of June.
Yes. So,
and what's the date, Ian?
Yeah, it's the 25th of July. So people have had 25 days to read.
That's what I mean, like less than a month.
And they'll have an extra month on top of that.
Yeah, anyway. So all I'm saying is because we do spoil these things, generally we don't try to do like new, brand new releases. So I do apologise for that.
Yeah, no. And Mexican Gothic, we are going to have a lot to talk about.
Yes. There will be no time
to discuss the Stephen Graham.
I've heard lots of really good things about both of them already. I haven't actually gone and read reviews. It's just like a general, these books are awesome, you must read them, they're the new best thing, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, I love both those authors.
You don't read my Locus reviews that I spend.
I don't read book reviews, Ian, unless I'm talking about the book myself. And then I want to know what other people have said.
Why do I bother?
Reviews, I don't know, for me reviews kind of spoil a book. I choose my books these days because of general, I guess, buzz and personal recommendations from people who I kind of trust. So it's like if someone who I know their reading preferences kind of gel with mine, or they know what I really like to read and what I would enjoy, and someone says, hey, you should read this, I will generally read that book, or at least I will buy that book. Whether I read it is another question.
I can't believe
I read over
a hot laptop writing those reviews, let me tell you.
You're not writing them for me, like personally. Because if you are, stop.
I'll tell Jonathan.
Because yeah,
my audience member's not reading them.
If,
sorry,
if they're for me, anymore. You can stop. I'll give you that time back.
Anyway.
All right.
Okay, so that was funny. So those are the two books we're doing next episode, next month. Please send feedback by commenting at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. Send an email at writerandcritic@gmail.com. Have we received any emails?
I didn't get any this month, I don't think.
You people. You can follow at writerandcritic on Twitter. And please do, because I still have the account and we do look at it. So, you know, feel free to comment.
That's so enticing.
That's what I'm here for.
You can also
sponsor us on Patreon if you can, but don't feel forced to.
And if you are a patron, you can of course also comment on the Patreon posts.
Yes,
if you would like to give feedback, and some people have been doing that, so thank you.
Yeah, well, yes, and like I said, there's been a couple of nice bits of feedback on Facebook. Not that we have a Facebook page, just people posting on their own pages. People saying these things are not that I remember any, like we said before, I don't remember anything that I say. So,
right. So I think we need to call it.
What have I said in this podcast? I think that you're wrong about the Facebookness of weather and delicacy of prose doesn't work for me when I'm in COVID situations.
That's basically
the key messages of these
key takeaways.
Why am I still talking? Okay.
I have to go. I have no words left.
Okay.
Goodbye, good. Everyone.
Yes. Bye.
I am just so tired all the time.